Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, April 26. I'm Ray Graff, and support comes from Saratoga Hospital and its Saratoga Medical Group with more than 30 specialty practices, including palliative care, geriatric care, podiatric surgery, and women's primary care. SaratogaHospital.org. Joining us on Medical Monday to discuss gastroenterology is Dr. David Furman of Southwestern Vermont Healthcare. And we advise you to call early. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have a question. Again, it's 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address, but the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Furman and your gastroenterology questions coming up on Medical Monday right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday today is gastroenterologist Dr. David Furman. Dr. Furman is at SVMC Gastroenterology and Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians in Bennington, Vermont. He received his medical degree from Boston University School of Medicine, then served for 11 years as an officer and physician in the United States Navy. He completed his internship and residency in internal medicine at the Portsmouth Naval Medical Center in Virginia, where he also served as chief resident in internal medicine. Dr. Furman was an instructor of functional gastrointestinal diseases at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. He's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, having served there from 2012 to 2013. You have a question for Dr. Furman, call us now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Furman, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to join you.
Very nice to have you here. Before we get to our questions via email and phone, let me ask you about Barrett's esophagus. Exactly how does it differentiate from ordinary inflammation or irritation of your esophagus? And how, in fact, is it a marker that may lead to possible esophageal cancer?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that there's a lot of concerns and misconceptions about Barrett's esophagus. So Barrett's esophagus is a benign but potentially precancerous condition that occurs in a small percentage of people who have chronic acid exposure in their esophagus from esophageal reflux. Now, generally speaking, most people who have esophageal reflux may get a little bit of acid irritation, but it doesn't really cause any kind of permanent changes or damage. Barrett's esophagus occurs when that lining of the esophagus adapts to try to accommodate that acid and starts to resemble tissue that would otherwise be found in the small intestine. But of those people who have Barrett's esophagus, only about a very small percentage, maybe 0.015%, are actually going to progress to dysplasia, which is the precancerous condition. So if you have Barrett's esophagus, it's something that we keep a close eye on. We'll usually repeat procedures to biopsy the areas, look for those precancerous changes every few years, but it certainly is not any kind of harbinger that you are definitely getting esophageal cancer.
So in other words, no reason to panic, per se.
No reason to panic, but certainly a reason to keep on top of it and stay connected with your primary doctor and your gastroenterologist for surveillance.
Dr. David Furman joins us today on this Medical Monday. This email came in from Michael in Latham. Michael writes, I've been diagnosed with diverticulosis. Last December, I had a severe bout of diverticulitis. I ended up in the emergency room because of the severe pain. I was given 2 antibiotics and sent home. My question is, how do I prevent this in the future? I've been given conflicting advice regarding dietary guidelines. Do you have any recommendations going forward? And that is from Michael in Latham.
Yeah, so Michael asked the question that we all ask, which is, how do we prevent our patients from developing this relatively common complication of diverticulosis? Now, diverticula are just these pockets that form in the wall of the colon. There are little outpouchings that develop from pressure buildup over time. And by the time we reach our 60s or 70s, probably 75% of us will have some diverticulosis. Only about 15% of us will actually have episodes of diverticulitis like Michael did. And that's usually manifest as pain, perhaps fevers, nausea. It's from inflammation or infection of those diverticular pockets. In the past, we used to think that part of what caused that was having seeds and nuts and other particles get stuck in those pockets. Over time, we've kind of realized that that's not the case, that when we do studies comparing people who avoid the seeds and nuts and people who eat them regularly, there's no difference in their rates of developing diverticulitis. There's also been a lot of debate about whether fiber is a good thing. Generally speaking, we usually think that eating a high fiber diet is helpful for diverticulosis and avoiding diverticulitis. But again, there is some controversy there. Ultimately, the most important advice to give people who have diverticulosis is to listen to their bodies. If you are experiencing symptoms that you associate with your prior diverticulitis, then it's probably in your best interest to seek medical attention about that right away. Not all diverticulitis requires antibiotics, but we certainly know that if it is severe enough, antibiotics are helpful and can prevent other complications. Ultimately, the only way to really prevent diverticulitis is if you've had multiple recurrences. Sometimes we'll refer people to a surgeon to have that segment of their colon actually resected, and people live a very healthy digestive life thereafter.
Dr. David Furman joins us. So let me just follow up here with a question about the intersection of science and medicine. Medicine is science, and it's also an art form. But you had mentioned that seeds and nuts were often given as, okay, well, this is one of the reasons you're going to get diverticulitis. They're going to get in those little bags, and they're going to cause trouble. How did that idea come about, and how did medical science disabuse itself of that?
Well, I have to presume that the idea came about, as many of these things do, that it just seemed to be common sense, that if you have pockets and things get stuck in them, that might be a source for complications to arise. Again, as I mentioned, you know, like with most of the theory in medicine, ultimately what science does is when we take those theories and we do hypothesis testing, do some sort of a study to see if our hypothesis really holds water. And in this case, studies were done where they would take large groups of people who avoid the seeds and nuts and large groups of people who don't, and then compare their outcomes over time. Unfortunately, there's not really too much way to know, looking at an individual colon, whether or not it was a seed or a nut that stuck in the colon that caused the diverticulitis. Although I can certainly tell you that from my personal experience, I've done lots and lots of colonoscopies, seen hundreds of thousands of diverticular pockets and lots of seeds and nuts in them, and none of those patients, as far as I know, had diverticulitis at the time.
We're joined today by Dr. David Furman. A couple of more emails here, and then we'll get to the phones. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. This one's from Barbara. And Barbara says, can you explain tortuous colon? It was found on my colonoscopy, but not discussed. And that is from Barbara.
Yeah, so the best that we know, saying that someone has a tortuous colon may be no different from saying that someone has curly hair or freckles or blue eyes, that it's just part of how your body is built. In fact, all of our colons are tortuous to some degree. We've got lots of twists and turns. But certainly there are some people who have more twists and turns in their colon than others.
All right.
It becomes an issue in a couple of manners. With a colonoscopy, certainly someone who does have more twists and turns can have a more difficult colon to traverse for the doctor involved. And sometimes that can cause more discomfort in their colonoscopy. There also is some thought that for some people, having a tortuous colon may put them at greater risk of having issues with constipation. There really, however, is nothing that we can do to straighten out the colon, make it less tortuous. And we don't really have any way of looking from the outside to know who has a particularly tortuous colon. So, and it's honestly not something that we typically discuss with our patients besides just making note of it on a report. And there it's mostly to pass that information on to whoever might be doing the next colonoscopy.
I tell you what, let's take a break right here, and then we'll get back to the email bag and the phones. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Gastroenterology today on Medical Monday. Dr. David Furman joins us, and we'll be right back. Medical Monday on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined today by Dr. David Furman, and this email from Lou in Altamont. The question is, what do you think of the FODMAP diet? Please explain any issues for or against. That's from Lou. You better tell me what that is first, and then tell me about the issues.
Sure. So the FODMAP diet, that's capital FODMAP, is perhaps the most widely prescribed diet for managing common gastrointestinal distress, particularly irritable bowel syndrome. The letters stand for fermentable oligo, di, and monosaccharides and polymers. Basically, it refers to foods that our body can't break down particularly well in the digestive tract, and consequently, you have large molecules passing through, reaching the bacteria that live in our lower intestine, which then feed on that bacteria, produce gas, and draw liquid into the intestine, causing gas and loose stools and other inconvenient symptoms. So to answer Lou's question about the FODMAP diet, like I said, it is probably the most widely prescribed diet these days for irritable bowel and other digestive complaints. It can be a very restrictive diet. Most of these involve lots of fruits and vegetables that we commonly eat, things like broccoli and asparagus and cabbage and onions. Also contains lots of breads and cereals, dairy products, high fructose corn syrups, things like that. And the recommendation that I usually give to my patients is that I'll present the diet to them, give them a list of foods that they should be aware of, but I tell them to not necessarily, it doesn't mean they can't eat any of those foods, but they need to use them in moderation. Oftentimes people with that list can find individual foods that really seem to be major triggers for them, and cutting those individual foods out of their diet is far more helpful for them than eliminating the whole group as a whole.
We're joined today by Dr. David Furman from SVMC Gastroenterology and Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians in Bennington, Vermont. If you have a question for Dr. Furman, give us a call, 800-348-2551. We go to Gregory in Bethel Woods. Gregory.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're on. Go ahead.
Yes. So, like I explained, Dr., I'll be 68 years old in August. I was diagnosed with severe ulcerated colitis 6 years ago. I went through 4 years of all types of infusions, 4 hours of Remicade, Humira, Entyvio. Absolutely no remission. Very agonizing. I went to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, New York City, where I spoke with a surgeon, had full colon removal. With the ostomy on my stomach. Then a year later, I made the choice. The doctors decided I was strong enough to go with reconstructive surgery of the small intestines, and I had a J-pouch procedure. Now I stayed in that condition with the ostomy bag for about a year. And I've recently just had the reversal of the ostomy bag. But it still comes with some pain, suffering, anguish, and I'm still at between my age and how I feel physically, very run down, less weight than I had in the past. I try not to eat after 8 o'clock at night because I would be running to the bathroom all night long, and I'm still confused on. I haven't spoken to a dietitian on. What precautions should I be taking as far as a diet goes? They're telling me I can go high fiber, then another GI doctor says high fiber is not good because it's like a sandpaper on your intestinal tract. So I'm a little confused on what's the best direction for me at this point in my life.
Yeah, well, thanks, Gregory. It certainly sounds like you have been through a lot with your ulcerative colitis, and unfortunately, that is the road that a lot of people still go through with ulcerative colitis. It can be a serious condition. Most people are able to find a medication regimen that will keep things under control sufficiently, but certainly there are plenty of people like yourself who do end up having to go for a total colectomy. Now, we usually talk about total colectomy as being a curative surgery for ulcerative colitis, because if you don't have a colon, you can't have ulcerative colitis anymore. But once your colon is removed, then you have the job of hoping that your remaining digestive tract can make the adjustment so that your body can function as close to normal, even without having that large organ, the colon, involved in the process. Now, yes, there are a couple of different aspects that are involved in that. So one of them is that, our small intestine, so what's left in your digestive tract, its main job is not really to help package up our waste the way that the large intestine is. The small intestine is really intended for absorbing nutrients. And for most people over time, the lower part of the small intestine will start to adapt and start to develop some of those functions that previously have been taken on by the colon. But that can be a long process, and it does take time. Now, I can't really give you a specific time frame, how many months or years, and I think it really varies from person to person. Oftentimes using some sort of an antidiarrheal medication like loperamide, which is the kind of run-of-the-mill antidiarrheal that's found in over-the-counter products like Imodium, can help to slow things down.
Do take. Thank you.
Good. And you can really use as much or as little of that as you need to. In terms of are there particular foods, that's really a much more difficult question, because again, everybody is different. But the low FODMAP diet that I had mentioned before is something that may be helpful for you, just in terms of limiting some of those materials that our body can't process very well. Fiber, I would think that fiber would probably be a helpful thing for you, just because it can add bulk to the material moving through and can help balance some of the excess liquid. But then the other thing that needs to be considered is that one of the things that can occur after people have had the surgery you had is that the remaining part of or your J pouch, and for people not familiar with the surgery, a J pouch is something that the surgeons basically construct out of the small intestine to act like a rectum. And
right,
that can become inflamed even in the absence of any more ulcerative colitis. And oftentimes we'll use probiotics to help get that under control. If you still have a gastroenterologist managing you, they can certainly help you with that. But these are complicated issues.
I apologize to interrupt. I am taking a probiotic, which is a refrigerated Visbom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've had one GI doctor tell me I shouldn't be on probiotics, and then the private sector GI doctor says, yes, I do need the probiotics.
Right.
Like you said, to help protect the small intestines down in that J pouch region.
Yeah.
So you would recommend probiotics?
I usually recommend that for my patients after they've had a total colectomy as a way of protecting against this condition we call pouchitis. If it's not working for you, then certainly perhaps someone needs to evaluate the area and see if that's all that's going on.
Gregory, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday, Gastroenterology Today with Dr. David Furman. Our number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Jim and Matamoros, Jim, you're on.
Does sleeping position affect the function of the GI system, i.e. side sleeping versus back or belly sleeping?
Ah.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, considering the way that our digestive tract is positioned in the body, and specifically the stomach in the body, in theory, laying on your left side when you sleep should be helpful for keeping material that's in your stomach from refluxing up into your esophagus and into your chest. If you are someone who gets heartburn at night. As far as digestive function for absorbing our nutrients and having normal bowel movements and whatnot, as far as I know, how you're lying really shouldn't make too much of a difference there. There are some individual conditions where a position can put particular pressure on some of the internal organs, but those tend to be very rare conditions and would be unlikely to be of much impact. There are lots of people who, again, speaking of nighttime reflux, whether you're lying on your side or lying on your back, having a little bit of a tilt in the bed so that your head is a little bit above your feet can also be helpful just in terms of helping gravity keep material in your stomach rather than allowing it to reflux up into the chest.
Jim, thank you very much for the call. This is very interesting, Dr. Furman. You said, in theory, lying on one's left side may help from having nighttime heartburn or reflux. In practice, have you seen that?
I don't get reflux myself at night, so I haven't been able to try it out.
Oh, lucky you.
But I do have some patients who have told me that that is helpful and that they sleep with a pillow in a certain way to help prop them up.
Fascinating. Dr. David Furman is our guest. Gastroenterology is the topic on Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If you have a question, you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Edwin is in Schenectady. Edwin, you're on.
I am 77, about 5 years since my previous colonoscopy. I've always produced a few completely normal polyps. And I wonder when it would be recommended to get another colonoscopy, if at all.
Yeah, so I can tell you that the current guidelines recommend that everybody be screened routinely up through age 75. And then between 75 and 85, we do things on a case-by-case basis based on a few factors. Those include your individual risk factors for colon cancer, such as do you have a strong family history of colon cancer, or have you been someone who grows lots of polyps and have had multiple polyps found on your previous procedures. And then, of course, also weighing in what your current health status is like and what the safety risks might be for you for colonoscopy. If you've had polyps on your colon in the past, then depending on what kind of polyps those are and how many, certainly I would probably recommend that you continue having colon cancer screening. Now, there have been some changes over the years in terms of how frequently people should be screened after having polyps removed. And the most important of those changes is that where we used to recommend anyone who had any precancerous polyps, what we call adenomas, even if it was only one or two of them, should be screened at least every 5 years. And the most recent guidelines that were just published in the past year have pushed that out to 7 to 10 years after having just one or two small adenomatous polyps.
Mine were not adenomatous.
So now some of the other kinds of polyps that people might have are hyperplastic polyps. These are completely benign, meaning that even if they're left in your body and have a chance to grow forever, they don't turn into cancer. If you had just hyperplastic polyps, have never been someone who grew any adenomas, then it certainly might be reasonable for you to say, you know, if you haven't grown anything by now, you're probably not going to, and I would give you a gold star and say you've graduated from the colon cancer screening program.
Okay, thank you.
Edwin, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Furman joins us on Medical Monday, Gastroenterology Today, and we go to Carol in Saratoga. Carol, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
I have recently had my gallbladder removed, and several doctors say, oh, now you can eat whatever you want, but I've done some reading, and they discuss other thoughts on that. What are your thoughts on how to digest fast properly?
Yeah, thanks, Carol. I hope that you're doing well after having your gallbladder removed. I hope it took care of the problems that you were having.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, so
one attack
keep in mind
was all that, I needed.
One attack.
Okay, great. Yeah, so keep in mind that the gallbladder plays an important function in the body. It stores bile, and bile is helpful in our digestion, particularly for digesting fats. But having had your gallbladder removed does not mean that your body is not making bile anymore. The liver makes mm-hmm. bile. That bile travels down the bile duct into the small intestine when we eat. And so you should still have plenty of bile to be able to digest fats. So from that standpoint, you know, a statement of you can eat whatever you want certainly is true. Now, there are some other digestive problems that sometimes people will develop after they've had their gallbladder removed that have to do with the body not being able to regulate that bile flow quite as well. And the most common of those problems is that some people will develop a recurrent diarrhea after they eat, what we refer to as a bile acid diarrhea, because the amount of bile coming through the small intestine just kind of overwhelms the system, draws a lot of extra water in with it. And if you are someone who's experiencing that, there is a supplement that you can take that will bind that extra bile and help you restore normal bowel function. But in terms of are there any specific foods that you should not eat, I tend to take a pragmatic approach and say you need to listen to your body. And if you are eating a broad range of foods and not having any issues, then there's no reason to restrict yourself.
Okay. Good to hear.
Good news indeed.
Thank you.
Carol, thanks a lot
You're
for the
welcome,
call.
Carol.
Our number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. David Furman, 800-348-2551. We'll grab an email here before we take a break, and then we'll hit the phones and the email bag once again for the home stretch. This is from Mary. Mary writes, can you discuss the latest research regarding Lynch syndrome and colon cancer? I don't know what Lynch syndrome is, so maybe you can give us a précis on that as well.
Yeah, so Lynch syndrome is one of two major genetic syndromes that predispose people towards developing colon cancer. It's a specific syndrome in which people don't necessarily grow more polyps, but the polyps that they grow progress to cancer much more quickly than otherwise. Risk factors for having Lynch syndrome include having family members who had not just colon cancer, but also a variety of other cancers in the body, including some reproductive organ cancers, some kidney cancers. There's a whole list of cancers that might put someone at risk of having Lynch syndrome. In terms of is there any new research available, to the best of my understanding, really the information that we know about Lynch is information that's been fairly stable over the years. We do know that most people who have Lynch syndrome are at a greatly increased risk of having colon cancer, and consequently, we recommend doing colon cancer screening beginning at a much earlier age and much more frequently than in the general population. If you think that you might have Lynch syndrome, we certainly do recommend that you get tested for it. There are people who have a family history of Lynch syndrome, but they themselves do not. And I would hate for you to be going through frequent colonoscopies unnecessarily for a syndrome that you don't actually have.
Let's take a quick break. Dr. David Furman is our guest. It's Gastroenterology Today on Medical Monday. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be back with a home stretch coming up. Medical Monday on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. We're joined today by Dr. David Furman, gastroenterologist at SVMC Gastroenterology and Dartmouth Hitchcock Putnam Physicians in Bennington, Vermont. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And Barb in Schenectady wrote us and says, protein for dinner? I'm a person who goes to bed early, 8 p.m.-ish. I usually eat dinner at 6. What I have found in the last few years is that if I have a heavier lunch and a lighter dinner, it really helps me sleep better. Is there any science behind not eating protein with my evening meal and improved sleep? And that's from Barb in Schenectady.
Well, Barb, that's a great question, probably for bigger brains than mine. Not so sure on the data on protein at night. We certainly do recommend that people limit fat intake at night, which of course is terribly inconvenient because nighttime meals, you know, we like having rich desserts and things like that. The reason why we restrict fat intake at night is because fat causes the stomach to empty more slowly, and so there's more of a likelihood that if you do have a fatty, heavy meal at night, there's more likelihood that it'll still be sitting in your stomach when you lay down at night and may put you at risk of having some heartburn symptoms at night. As far as protein, our body is pretty good at metabolizing protein and moving it through the body in an efficient way. Certainly, we do know that some proteins do contain chemicals that can make us a little bit more sleepy. And we've all had that experience of eating the big turkey dinner and then needing a nap afterwards. Ultimately, it sounds like what you're doing is working well for you, and I have no reason to tell you to stop.
All right. Our number here is 800-348-2551. And back to the phones we go on this Medical Monday. David is in Pittsfield. Hello there, David. You're on.
Hi. Hello. Doctor, my wife has had chronic diarrhea for the last 8 or 9 months. Any stool samples didn't seem to show anything conclusive. She was put on for controlling it, diphenoxylate, Lamotium or something like that. In any case, fast forward, the beginning of the month, she ended up in the critical care unit of the hospital. And ironically, after one day, she was found to have C. diff and then was put in isolation and has gone through the whole treatment for the control of that. My question is, could her chronic diarrhea also have been caused by C. diff all along and just not discovered?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. First of all, I'm sorry to hear about your wife. I hope that she's doing better now that she's getting medical care. Regarding chronic diarrhea, there are many things that can cause chronic diarrhea. Some of those can be infectious. Some of those can be chronic inflammation in the colon that have nothing to do with infection. Perhaps the most common reason for chronic diarrhea is what we refer to as a functional diarrhea, which is more of a neurologic disruption in the digestive tract where things just move through too quickly. Regarding C. difficile, C. difficile is tested for, first of all, it's a bacteria that can live in the colon, and if it overgrows in the colon, it can cause infection and cause a chronic diarrhea syndrome. We're pretty good at testing for it, though, and it's one of the more common things that doctors will test for in stool. The tests for a C. difficile in stool are generally very, very sensitive, and so I would expect that if she had C. difficile and was tested for it previously, that would have been detected. Now, the other thing to consider is that one of the risk factors for developing C. difficile infection is being on antibiotics. And sometimes in an effort to try to treat a chronic diarrhea syndrome, we will prescribe antibiotics. And so this may be a situation where the treatment, even though well-intentioned, may have ultimately perhaps created a risk factor for developing this still fairly common infection. Fortunately, yeah. Now that she's getting care, C. difficile is usually something that we can treat fairly well, and so hopefully she's doing better.
Yeah, she is doing better, but it would just seem like you don't get C. diff in one day at the hospital. doesn't show
no,
up.
No,
you know, one day.
You certainly don't, but but it's also something that people can develop at any time, even in the setting of some other sure. kind of diarrheal illness.
Okay, David.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. Now we go to Richard in Glenville. Richard. Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on.
Okay. I've been on Nexium equivalent for many years. Is there any disadvantage to staying on that medication for the rest of my life?
Yeah, thanks, Richard. That is probably one of the most common questions that we get as gastroenterologists these days regarding medication. Nexium, which is considered a proton pump inhibitor, is a very good medication that decreases acid production in the stomach, as I'm sure you know, and is certainly the most commonly prescribed type of medication for treating chronic acid reflux or indigestion symptoms. And worldwide, these are among the most widely prescribed medications in any field. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, a few years ago there were some studies that were that got a lot of press that called into question whether being on these medications long term is safe to do. Unfortunately, these original studies were retrospective studies, meaning they went through people's charts and compared charts of people who take these medications regularly with people who don't, and looked to see what health problems each of these two groups had, and they found that people who were on, say, chronic Nexium perhaps had a greater association with other health issues, including dementia, heart disease, kidney problems, bone disease. But when we've done prospective studies, which are the much more scientifically valid kind of study, we're not finding those associations in nearly the same kind of percentages. And we think that part of what caused the original question was, you know, to some degree, the more doctors you see, the more chance you may end up on one of these medications. And so it may be a reverse effect. Ultimately, the current guidance from the American College of Gastroenterology is that these are still considered to be very safe medications. But the recommendation is that you should use them in the lowest effective dose. So what I tell my patients is that if you've been on one of these medications and it seems to be doing great, you're not having any symptoms, periodically give yourself a holiday. Take a break from the medicine for a week or two. If your symptoms come right back again, then yes, you probably it's probably reasonable for you to stay on it for as long as it continues to be helpful. On the other hand, if stopping the medication, you don't feel any worse, then leave it in the medicine cabinet for if and when those symptoms do resume. But overall, if the medicine is doing well for you, I think it's reasonable to continue.
Richard, thanks very much for the call. It's Medical Monday today, gastroenterology with Dr. David Furman. And our number is 800-348-2551. Jeff in Manhattan. Jeff, you're on. Jeff, what's going on?
Hi. So this may be in the same realm as the last caller, but I was wondering the best way to determine or to decipher between post-nasal drip and sinus issues and GERD. I've been told that what's going on with me, some swallowing difficulty and hoarseness could be attributed to either or. And I'm just trying to figure out the best way to sort of combat it and decipher the difference between the two and what's at the root of the situation.
Yeah, Jeff, that's a very common question. And I often remark to my patients about the dance that people go through getting handed off from doctor to doctor when they are experiencing throat symptoms like chronic cough or hoarseness or having a lump in your throat. Because depending on what doctor you see first, you're probably going to be told that it's someone else's problem. If you see the ear, nose, and throat, they're going to tell you it's a reflux problem. And if you see the gastroenterologist, they're going to tell you it's the post-nasal drip. And if you see it, the pulmonologist, they're going to tell you it's either of the other two. Ultimately, there are some actual objective tests that we can do to measure reflux. So just a plain upper endoscopy where we go in through your mouth with a camera down into the esophagus and look for signs of acid irritation really is not the best way to know, do you have reflux? Really the best way to know if you have reflux is to do a special kind of study where we actually measure the reflux, measure either acid changes in the esophagus, we call pH monitoring, or measuring fluid medium changes in the esophagus, what we call impedance testing. And these are more specialized kind of testing procedures. But that's the best way to objectively state whether or not you have reflux. And then we can actually correlate it with some of your symptoms. Otherwise, we can decipher between postnasal drip or reflux by trying to treat one or the other and see which one seems to have the better effect.
Right. So, doing a course of Nexium or whatever versus Claritin, for instance.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry to use product names, but...
And one of the things that tends to complicate this, yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, is there a difference between, can you decipher something from a scope, let's say, through an ENT that goes down the throat? I mean, how beneficial is that versus a upper endoscopy in this particular kind of situation?
Right. So, first of all, keep in mind that they look for different things. The ENT is looking through the nose down into the we call it the hypopharynx, the lower part of the throat, and they're looking for redness, signs of irritation, perhaps lumps or bumps on the vocal cords. And they'll often report those signs of irritation as signs of reflux. On an upper endoscopy from a gastroenterologist, we're looking in the esophagus, and so we're looking for signs of acid irritation in the esophagus. But people can certainly have a very significant reflux and not have any visible acid irritation in the esophagus itself. The challenge that I always pose to your nose and throat doctors about seeing that redness in the throat is if you've got someone who's been clearing their throat for a long period of time or coughing, whether that's a response to postnasal drip or a response to reflux, it's going to cause irritation. It's going to cause redness. And so to some degree, what we're seeing on our studies can be more of a effect rather than an indication of the cause.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. David Furman is our guest, and let's go to Saugerties. Linda, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. My husband has been diagnosed with ulcerative sigmoid proptosis, and unfortunately, it took 25 years to find that out. One doctor said he had like a heart attack in his colon. But since then, my husband is in such bad shape where his back, he's had three back surgeries. And the last one, they put a stimulator. They did hip surgery. That failed. One leg's longer than the other. So he can't exercise. And then he had knee surgery, and both of those have failed. So he's gained like over 100 pounds. And he can't even do walk long. So even with diet, he's not losing any weight. And I'm afraid he's also had a heart attack. So I'm wondering, is it possible, because it's at the end of the colon, they can't do a resection. But is there something that they can do for him to lose weight? He has high cholesterol.
Wow.
And he's had hypertension and migraine.
It's a lot to unpack.
It certainly sounds like he has a lot of health issues. And frankly, ulcerative proctosigmoiditis is, in the grand scheme of things, though it can cause a lot of nuisance issues, is not a life-threatening problem for most people. And so his other issues are probably, more important. In terms of managing ulcerative proctosigmoiditis or ulcerative proctitis, and this is just inflammation in the lower part of the colon, there are good medications that should be able to get that under control. Most of those are given as enemas or as suppositories, just so it's topical treatment. Yeah, mesalamine.
Yeah, you're taking mesalamine and HD Azacol.
Yeah, and so hopefully those things will help get that under control. In terms of exercise, there really is, to my knowledge, is not anything that exercise will do for managing inflammation in the colon, but certainly can help with overall sense of well-being. Again, I think that the more important issue for him is to get his other cardio and pulmonary issues under control so that he can ambulate. In terms of asking about surgery, only in very, very severe situations would the kind of condition that you're describing your husband require him to have a surgery. So I don't think that you have much to worry about yourself with that. But if the treatments aren't working, there are other medications beyond what he's taking, and I would just consult with his gastroenterologist, and they're probably going to do a stepwise approach, moving from the most benign medications to the more expensive or more involved medications as he needs it.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Now, doctor, we only have 90 seconds left here, but we'll quickly go to Katrina in upstate New York. Katrina, we got to make it quick here.
Okay. Hi. I am in my 30s. I have a question about diarrhea. I usually have one bowel movement a day, and it's either diarrhea or loose. And generally, with it, and it's generally dust in the morning, but I feel like they're not bowel movements, and I'm just wondering your thoughts on reasons or causes or
We're having some signal breakup there. Do you get any of that, doctor?
Yeah, so Katrina, you know, thanks for your call. I think enough. You know, it sounds like you're having one or two loose stools each day, particularly in the morning, and that's probably the most common pattern that people have with benign functional abnormalities such as irritable bowel. The most helpful thing that I recommend is either using some sort of a daily fiber product, something like psyllium, or even using one Imodium tablet a day can be very helpful just for slowing things down. You also may want to just keep a food diary and see are there particular foods that are setting things off worse than others, but that is a very common pattern to have.
All right, Katrina, we'll have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Well, Dr. David Furman, you did very well, sir. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we will talk to you soon, I am sure. Support comes from Berkshire Orthopedic Associates, an affiliate of Berkshire Health Systems, providing orthopedic services in the Berkshires, including Mako robotic surgery, sports medicine, and anterior hip surgery, 413-499-6600. Once again, thanks to Dr. David Furman of Southwestern Vermont Healthcare for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the terrific calls and the emails. Apologies if we did not get to your question. We will do this topic again. It comes up periodically on this Medical Monday. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who is our engineer. Thanks to Joe Makowicz, who screened the calls. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, all right, now you get your computer questions ready. I have a computer question. My Windows update has been trying to update at home for the last week and a half. It says you need to restart. I restart. I come back. It says you need to restart. There's a problem, and I'm going to put it to Tony Yang tomorrow from Gig Computers and see if he can help me. If he can't, it's going to be a long hour. Join us tomorrow at 2 p.m. for that one. Stand by now for the Media Project.